Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that space, understanding the nature of the enemy that we are confronting, specifically the global jihadist movement, is a critical piece to success in this war. And a man who is giving it a lot of thought and who has considerable expertise on the subject is our first guest. He is Michael S. Smith II. He is currently a founder and principal of Kronos Advisory, LLC, but he has been spending a lot of time in recent years serving as an expert for congressional estimates of what is going on, including the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare. He's also with Wikistrat, a geopolitical analysis firm. It's always good to have you with us, Michael, especially at a moment when there's so much confusion about the nature of the enemy, particularly the various flags they are flying at the moment. Welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be with you and your listeners again.
So how do you characterize the differences, Mike, between Al-Qaeda in its various forms and franchises, the Islamic State, and what is now, it seems, an increasing array of, well, affiliated groups, at the very least, people who have sworn loyalty to them, Daesh, I guess they're also now being called by some, and for that matter, the Muslim Brotherhood. What are the distinctions that we should focus on, if any, at the moment?
Well, I think that the critical distinctions arise from the strategies adopted to, quote-unquote, restore the caliphate, strategies adopted by the leaders of Al-Qaeda and their subordinates versus the current and former leadership of the enterprise that is now calling itself the Islamic State. Essentially, Al-Qaeda had long been engaged in what my colleague, former CIA senior Al-Qaeda analyst Cindy Storer and I recently referred to as a protracted popular war. It sort of borrows from Mao's playbook. Effectively, they wanted to develop popular support for their cause and mobilize the masses in support of that revolutionary activism, as they would call it, to borrow from the language put forward in former Muslim Brotherhood official Syed Qutb's infamous jihadi manifesto signposts or milestones. Meanwhile, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, of course, adopted a strategy that was a bit of an aberration from that. He was much more brutal.
This was, again, the Al-Qaeda leader in Iraq until he was killed by U.S. forces.
Correct. And Al-Qaeda's leadership at various points in history cautioned him about the blowback that might be encountered and very bluntly advised him that what he was doing in terms of the brutality, the killing of so many Muslims, the indiscriminate attacks, etc., was degrading their capabilities to develop the sort of brand equity, the popular support that they wanted for the Al-Qaeda brand in Iraq and neighboring environs. So I think that it's important to understand that strategically these elements have adopted different approaches.
But it is towards the same goal. That's the point I think you're making.
Very much so.
How does the Graham Wood's analysis that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly bear on all of this as you see it? And is your analysis with Cindy at Downrange, your website, sort of a corrective to what you think he got wrong?
In some respects, it is a bit of a rejoinder. By and large, though, and I've visited with Graham in recent weeks, we thought that he performed very dynamic and really produced a very interesting and worthwhile expose concerning the ideology of the Islamic State. One could read it and at various points throughout his material draw a conclusion that perhaps the Islamic State's ideology varies significantly from that of Al-Qaeda, thus the goals, interests, etc., are different, and that's frankly not the case. The biggest area of concern in terms of differences between the groups really boils down to strategy, and that's what counterterrorism practitioners need to keep in mind. And policymakers, frankly, would be an error to assume that the Islamic State's ideology, thus its agenda, is in any way more dangerous or radical than that of Al-Qaeda. The big difference here is that the Islamic State is in a much greater hurry to achieve certain ends, to demonstrate that it is capable of achieving its overarching goal of restoring a caliphate.
Which is, of course, again, the shared goal, and imposing this program they call Sharia worldwide in the process. One of the things, Michael Smith, that you have talked about and that is, of course, quite worrying is that there are some who have come to the conclusion, wrongly, I think we would agree, that there are moderates in some of these groups, notably Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah or Hamas, and most especially the Muslim Brotherhood, with whom we can safely do business against the more extreme versions of this jihadist program, whether it's the Islamic State or whether it's, well, I guess for that matter, Iran. What are your thoughts on how accurate that characterization is?
Well, obviously, the current administration in Washington, the administration before that, and administrations before that, sought to engage with elements in particular of the Muslim Brotherhood on matters concerning counterterrorism, countering violent extremism, as we now call it.
As they call it, Michael, I don't think that I would indulge in that myself. But yes, they do call it that.
Sure. Yeah, it's not you or I in particular. But anyway, back to it. You know, there's been a long-standing effort to engage with, in particular, elements of the Muslim Brotherhood, to partner with them. And to be frank with you, I think that there is obviously some irony. Essentially, what we're looking at now in terms of the threat environment is a manifestation of sweeping political reforms or efforts to achieve those reforms that were initiated by Hassan al-Banna when he created the Muslim Brotherhood back in 1928 in response to the abolition of the caliphate. The Muslim Brotherhood obviously is not as violent in its activism as Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State. But again, it's ironic because the inception of this movement as we see it now, its manifestations in the activities of these jihadis, all boils down to the early agenda put forward by Hassan al-Banna and amplified in the writings of Syed Qutb, who, of course, created a veritable playbook for jihadis to go out and endeavor to restore the caliphate.
Yeah, including, unfortunately, here in places like the United States, the civilization jihad, where they use nonviolent means, or I think of them as pre-violent means, to advance the same agenda until they're strong enough to use the preferred techniques of violence. Speaking of violence here, Michael Smith, again, is our guest, co-founder of Kronos Advisory LLC and a highly regarded and widely recognized counterterrorism expert in this country. What do you make of the announcement by ISIS-related group that they have the list of names and addresses of 100 or so military personnel who have been involved in the fight against them? Is this a credible threat to those men and women in uniform who have been serving their country in the face of these jihadists?
Generally speaking, terrorist groups very much want to be able to demonstrate a capability to match words and deeds. In January, Al-Qaeda, of course, demonstrated that it can do so in a very targeted manner when it murdered an employee of Charlie Hebdo who was added to one of their hit lists that was previously published in Inspire magazine. Clearly, the Islamic State will be able to do the same, competing for interest and affinity among the same pools of jihadis, financiers of jihads, etc. So I think that this is a threat, just like the threat to the executives and employees of Twitter, that should be taken very seriously. In addition to the military personnel who were advertised in that hit list, there was also at the very bottom of it an email correspondence between a former USG contractor and one of his sources. That correspondence occurred when that individual was performing research work focused on Islamist elements active in the United States. That's something that hasn't received a great deal of attention. I've spoken with that individual since then, and he's concerned and interested in learning more about precautions that would be advisable for him to take.
Understandably. Michael Smith, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you very much for the great work you're doing at Kronos Advisory. Check it out at Downrange as well, if you would, folks. And Michael, come back to us again very soon with updates as you see fit. Next up, we'll be speaking with Ilan Berman. We'll get his take on this jihadism and what the administration is doing with respect to Israel that may invite the next war. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the Global Jihad Movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by a friend and colleague at the American Foreign Policy Council. He is its Vice President, Ilan Berman, the author of almost innumerable essays and books. One of the most recent is one on Iran's strategic penetration of Latin America. He writes at Forbes.com and the National Interest. You see him frequently in various other formats, but we have him here as a very favored guest from time to time. Always delighted to welcome him back. Welcome once more, Ilan Berman.
Wonderful to be back.
Well, I hardly know where to begin. It is such a target-rich environment, Ilan, but you've been writing on several topics that are of particular interest. Maybe we could start with the idea of reforming Islam so as to sort of somehow extirpate the jihadist pieces of it that have proven to be so deadly for a lot of Muslims as well as a lot of the rest of us. You point to Morocco as a place where there may be some promise of this. Ayan Hirsi Ali has written a book on the subject recently, and I'd just like to get your thoughts, Ilan, as to how these reformists are faring, and is it translating in Morocco, for example, into real change in the nature of the religious practice?
Right. So I think it's important to sort of to unpack a couple things sort of from the start, right? We're not talking about reforming Islam in the context of the fact that in Morocco, Islam is radicalized and we're trying to sort of to do an overhaul. The reason Morocco strikes me as a very interesting case, and it's not necessarily a model, but it's certainly an exception to the type of rather strident radical Islam that you see elsewhere in the region, is because, first of all, they have a very interesting claim to legitimacy. The king of Morocco traces his lineage back to the Prophet Muhammad, and so he has authority to actually push back against radical Islamic narratives if he wants to and say that his interpretation trumps. You don't see that elsewhere in the region on a sort of on a very big scale, which allows groups like ISIS, groups like al-Qaeda, to say that their narrative is a dominant one because it's backed by the gun.
Our guest is the Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council, Dr. Ilan Berman, a man who has contributed mightily, both in his work at the Council and elsewhere, to our understanding of some of the challenges we're facing, notably from the global jihad. And Ilan, you were talking about Morocco's king as having legitimacy. What has he actually been able to accomplish using that legitimacy to try to moderate, again, not so much the religious practice as the sort of political character of Sharia?
Well, the interesting thing to me about the way the king has moved his interpretation of Islam into the political sphere is by instituting a series of reforms that they've done over the last decade and a half that have really laid the predicate, if they continue to move in that direction, that's a big caveat, to have a sort of a fundamentally different version of Islam at home than you see elsewhere in Saudi Arabia and Iran and elsewhere. For example, in 2004, they instituted a pretty drastic overhaul of their national social cult called the Mutuana. And by doing so, they elevated the status of women. Women can now initiate divorces. They can inherit equally. They even have a cadre. It's not a very big cadre yet, but a cadre of female preachers that can do everything except the lead Friday prayer. Now, there's plenty of warts and blemishes on this system, but clearly it's different than the Saudi system and even than the Turkish system. And as a result, you know, my sense is there's power in diversity, so it's something to look at.
It will be interesting to watch whether it translates into real change or whether it will be confined, even such as it is, to the areas in which this king exercises control. There seems to be a lot of sentiment for Sharia in his own country, so it isn't a sure thing by any means, as I think you're saying, Ilan Berman. Ilan, let me switch gears with you. We're watching a very, very dramatic, even turbulent moment in U.S.-Israeli relations. You have followed closely the strategic relationship between our two countries. What is going on at the moment, as you see it, and what are the stakes if it persists?
Well, nothing good is going on, and I think it's very clear from the press reports and from the public statements coming out of the White House that the relationship, which was on the skids before, has taken a dramatic turn for the worse because the White House's expected outcome, which is that Prime Minister Netanyahu would be unseated by the sort of the upstart liberal faction, liberal bloc that was created by Tzipi Livni and Michael Herzog, sort of on the left of the Israeli political spectrum, that they would successfully rise to power. And as a result, the Israeli government would be less confrontational, less unilateral, and less in opposition to the administration's interpretation of certain issues, chief among them, the way Bibi had opposed the Iranian nuclear deal. That, of course, didn't happen. You saw a pretty significant mandate for Prime Minister Netanyahu's government. He broadened his mandate, and as a result, he's building a conservative coalition almost exclusively from Israel's right. And that means that the Israeli government is going to be more stable, but it's going to be more conservative, and it's going to be more opposed to the policy initiatives of the Obama administration.
We will come to Iran in just a moment, but in terms of the actual dangers associated with the United States signaling that it is, if not indifferent to Israel's security needs, certainly less reliable in terms of protecting it, whether it's at the United Nations or in the peace process or more broadly. Ilan Berman, is this something that could conceivably give rise to further temptations on the part of people who don't have to be egged on to attack Israel or to otherwise try to take it down?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the U.S.-Israeli strategic relationship has always worked best because of the principle of strength in numbers, because Israel is surrounded by a very hostile neighborhood, and the idea that the United States has Israel's back really does support Israeli initiatives in the region and is willing to back the Israeli government and its security with American force and American political force and military force is the sine qua non of the relationship. And more as you move into this period where there is a divergence, it's a political divergence, not necessarily a strategic one, but in politics, optics are everything. And it looks like the White House is walking away from the relationship that's liable to give the enemies of the state of Israel lots of ideas and not good ones.
Yeah, and this brings us back to Iran. This is a country particularly that has made no secret, as you know so well, Ilan Berman, and you've documented in numerous books that you've written over the years, about the nature of the Iranian regime and its determination to, as Ahmadinejad once most famously put it, wipe Israel off the map. To the extent that Israel is confronting this growing peril of a nuclear deal that will legitimate the Iranian bomb, not prevent it, to what extent might this kind of insecurity that the administration seems determined to exacerbate on the part of Israel result in precisely the thing that they seem most determined to try to avoid, namely some kind of preemptive action by Israel against Iran?
No, I think that's exactly right. Look, the administration, its primary mode of conduct towards the Israeli government has always been to lecture and to essentially dictate terms, knowing full well that in the strategic relationship, because of a whole number of things, the U.S. is the senior partner. But the reality is that the way the Obama administration has conducted these negotiations with Iran, the opaque way they've done it, the unaccountable way that they've sort of skirted Congress and skirted transparency on the negotiations. Nobody quite knows exactly what the Obama administration has offered to the Iranians. And as a result, fearful attitudes are rife. They're not only rife on Capitol Hill, as you've seen, but they're also rife in Israel. And the idea that bringing Israel into the fold will dampen the possibility of unilateral military action was, I think, the initial rationale for having conversations with Israel. But that principle has long ago fallen by the wayside. The Israelis don't have a lot of insight into what we're doing with Iran. They're getting very nervous. And the more nervous they get, the more likely they are to act on their own.
And we're hearing reports that they've actually been spying on the negotiations to try to compensate for what the administration is denying them in terms of insights into its deal. I must tell you, my sympathies are with the Israelis in this, given what's at stake for them and the very troubling behavior of the administration towards them. Ilan Bremann, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We appreciate very much what you do at the American Foreign Policy Council, Forbes, and the National Interest and elsewhere. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon. Representative Diane Black joins us next on the anti-Christian genocide. More straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. A problem for states across the country became a public policy controversy in Irving, Texas last week. The city's mayor, Beth Van Dyne, decided to oppose the establishment in her city of the first Islamic tribunal in America. She's being viciously criticized for doing so. The tribunal's proponents have declared their ambition to have it serve as a model for similar Sharia courts elsewhere. They assert their Islamic law must be applied even where it conflicts with the U.S. Constitution. Fortunately, the Irving City Council voted to reject the tribunal and endorse legislation that would prevent any such anti-constitutional foreign law from being practiced in Texas courts. A Texas House committee will be considering such legislation today. Eight other states have adopted similar protections. Irving is showing why it's needed. This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a pleasure to welcome, once again, Representative Diane Black. She represents, with distinction, the people of the 6th District of Tennessee. She serves on what is always called the Influential Ways and Means Committee. She is also a liaison on that committee to the House Budget Committee, two very important committee assignments, particularly at the moment, as there is high drama with respect to the budget, even as we speak. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be with you, Frank, and thank you for calling me Congressman. I know some people wonder why that is, and it is a title that's given to us by the Constitution, so I am a congressman.
Thank you for joining us. You have taken a very prominent and I think very important leadership role in trying to raise awareness about and get corrective action taken towards the genocide that is now taking place. And I don't think that's too strong a term, towards Christians in the Middle East at the hands of what, for want of a better term, I guess are jihadists, certainly Islamic supremacists. You have a resolution on this subject. Talk about the larger problem and specifically what you're hoping to do with your colleagues in the House.
Certainly. Well, first of all, let's just acknowledge one of the main issues here is that we have an administration that won't name the enemy, you know, the radical Islamic terrorists. And until you name the enemy and you know who the enemy is, it's awfully difficult to take care of the situation. And it's not just Christians, but it's other religious minorities there in the Middle East that are being persecuted and martyred because of their faith. And so we want to address this. It's a travesty. Our country has always stood for the bedrock of the right to religion. And so this resolution, House Resolution 139, acknowledges for our friends that are both Christian and other minorities, that the United States is aware of what's going on and that we want to be a partner in saying this needs to stop. You might remember that when my former colleague Frank Wolf from Virginia was here, he offered a similar resolution, and that resolution was actually passed by both the House and the Senate, and it was signed into law by the president. And we are now seeing that what was in that law is not being followed through by the president. And so there really are four pieces of this. First of all, we want to condemn the violence. And condemning it is one thing, but we also need to take action. We want to reaffirm that the United States is promoting religious freedom and tolerance around the world, as we always have. And we want to call on those governments in the Middle East to uphold their internationally recognized human rights to freedom from religious persecution. And then finally, as was signed into law by the president back in 2014, we're asking him to put the envoy together, a special envoy, promote this religious freedom on minorities in the Middle East. And that was a passage of a measure called the Near East and South Central Asia Religious Freedom Act. And so that special envoy has never been appointed. We're asking the president to appoint that envoy so we can actually show there is action being taken on behalf of those being persecuted.
Congressman Black, this is all important work. To what extent do you find there is a receptiveness on the part of your colleagues to taking at least these steps, let alone steps that might go further to actually punish those who are involved in this kind of repression?
I think you will see, as was done 2 years ago when this resolution was passed, a great support, bipartisan support across the aisle, where there will be agreement that we need to take this action. So when this does come to the floor, I think you will see the same kind of support that you saw back in 2014.
You know, one of the things that I'm struck by, and I commend you for this, it's vitally important work and so appreciated by those of us who have been watching really with horror this rising tide of what you call radical Islamic terrorism, jihadism, Sharia adherence, Islamic supremacism, whatever term you prefer, it is unquestionably on the march. And to some extent, as you know from your own state of Tennessee, there are some aspects of it that seem to be leaching into our own society. I was very heartened by a step taken by your state, I think the first in the nation, Congressman, at the state level, to adopt something called American Laws for American Courts. And this is of some interest to us, particularly because at the moment there's a fight underway in Texas to have a similar kind of prohibition on not any particular foreign law, but any foreign law that actually violates American constitutional rights. And you've spoken very powerfully of the importance of course, our First Amendment protection of freedom of religion, but there are also other religious and non-religious protections embodied in that Constitution that seem to be now under assault, not just elsewhere, but here. I wonder whether we ought to be as alive to this problem in our own country as elsewhere.
I will tell you that those back in the state who are following these bills certainly are doing what needs to be done at the state level to acknowledge that our Constitution and our laws here in America are supreme, and that when others come to our country, we invite, as has always been, folks to incorporate into our country when they come here as immigrants. We say we have the American dream. No other country has a dream like we do. That's the reason why people want to come to the United States. But at the same time, there is an acknowledgement through these kinds of measures, which, by the way, when Sandy Adams, my former colleague from Florida, had a similar kind of measure here in Congress to uphold the American laws, to say they are supreme to the nation and that no other law would usurp that. I was a major sponsor of that bill as well. And that is something we've always got to remember here in our country, is that as people come to our country, we acknowledge that they are coming to this country to incorporate into our society. And not that they can't still practice their own religion, but when it comes to law, our law reigns supreme.
Yeah, it's in the Constitution itself, Article 6, of course. Our guest is Congressman Diane Black from the 6th District of Tennessee. As I've earlier mentioned, a member of two important committees in the House, the Ways and Means Committee and the Committee on the Budget. We also produced recently at the Center for Security Policy, in fact, just hot off the presses, a new monograph about one particular vehicle that is, I'm afraid, contributing to the problem you just touched on, and that is a refugee resettlement initiative on the part of, I think it probably precedes this administration's behavior, but it's particularly egregious under this one, and that is bringing people into this country on a refugee status who may not be inclined to assimilate, who may actually intend to try to have their own religious beliefs or political system, for that matter, prevail. To the extent that we are extending refugee status, shouldn't we be making a point of trying to bring some of these Christians that you're talking about, who are being so brutally oppressed and even murdered here to this country, not just, well, unfortunately, it seems a lot of Islamic supremacists who aren't likely to be part of the program?
Well, I agree with you that when folks come to this country, once again, they are expected to assimilate. I'm not saying that they can't practice their own religion. We do have the First Amendment that allows people to practice their own religion. But when it comes to a law here, our law is supreme, as I've already said. And it does worry me that this administration does not stand up for those that are being persecuted in those other countries and give them an opportunity to flee here to this country if that is possible, such as those Coptic Christians that be continually persecuted and marginalized, and the kinds of things that you hear that they're doing to the families and the children and the women. And opening up the country for those refugees would is such a wonderful thing, and yet we don't see an administration that is moving in that direction and reaching that handout. You have the imprisonment of Pastor Saeed Abedini in Iran that we should be fighting to bring him back, and should be part of negotiations that we do with Iran is to bring him back here to our country. These are things that I believe we should be doing and reaching out to those people to say, we want you here as a refugee. We want to give you a safe haven. We want to recognize that we have a role in reaching out to those around the world who would find safety here in the arms of the American people.
Congressman Black, thank you so much for your very significant contributions to not only our understanding of this, but I think that of your House colleagues. We hope you'll keep up the good work and come back to us with a progress report on how it's going, if you would. Next up, we'll be talking with Peter Brooks of the Heritage Foundation. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by a friend and colleague of many years, Peter Brooks. I'm currently with the Heritage Foundation, where he is a senior fellow with responsibility for national security affairs. He is also a man with considerable experience in various senior positions in the United States government, including serving as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and in uniform as a Navy commander, now retired. He is a man who has also been a member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. So a broad portfolio and a great opportunity to catch up with him on several different fronts. Peter Brooks, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Let's talk first about a piece that you recently wrote, a warning about Vladimir Putin's latest target, which seems to be the Arctic. What's he up to up there, and is he likely to face any resistance to it?
Well, I mean, you know, the Russians have a long-standing interest, as you know, Frank, in the Arctic. I mean, they consider themselves an Arctic nation. They probably have the longest Arctic coastline of any country, probably rivaled by Canada, but I think it's probably the longest. And there's a lot of interest on the part of the Russians. And I wrote a piece in the Boston Herald last week talking about his military maneuvers up there, which came about a year to the day from when they annexed Crimea. And I saw it as kind of a strategic bookend to what he had done in Crimea. And he had this large military exercise that included, you know, 50-some ships, you know, tens of thousands of soldiers, you know, 100 or more aircraft. And I think, once again, he was flexing his muscles. And as I said in the column, while Putin isn't always clear about his whereabouts, remember he disappeared for 10 days, he is clear about his geopolitics. And that is, if you, you know, mess or you threaten or he feels threatened that his, in his periphery, he's going to take action. And it was interesting because I checked with some colleagues who follow these issues very closely, the Arctic very closely, and they said that the Russians have been playing pretty nice in the Arctic Council, which is the group of seven or eight nations, including the United States, Canada, Russia, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark, which is an Arctic nation through the through Greenland. And they've been playing pretty nice diplomatically about deciding how the natural resources up there, which some people say it could be one-third of the world's untapped natural resources, they're playing pretty nice diplomatically, but then they're flexing military muscle. So it's an interesting counterpunch to what they're doing in southern Russia, which is Crimea.
Yeah, and Ukraine as well. Do you think the two are related, Peter? Do you anticipate more of this kind of activity, either to back up whatever they're going to try to obtain diplomatically, as you say, or simply to serve as a sort of new locus for Russian aggressiveness?
Well, they've been interested in the Arctic for a long time. I wrote about it a number of years ago talking about this, their new assertiveness in the Arctic. They've always been interested in the Arctic, and obviously the potential for these resources, like I said, one-third of the world's yet to be discovered, but technologically attainable natural resources, including oil and gas, are up there. So Russia has a very strong interest. As you know, I think it was John McCain who said this, and maybe he wasn't the first, but I think it's pretty good, is that, you know, Russia is a gas station masking as a country. And, you know, the fact is that they've not taken advantage of the opportunities that were afforded to them after the fall of the Soviet Union to develop themselves economically. They're not an export powerhouse except for energy and natural gas and oil. So I think they're concerned about that, and they want to keep their economy afloat, and that requires that they have continuing access to these sort of resources. So I think there's definitely an interest up there, but I think it's all part of what's going on in Ukraine, as you mentioned. I mean, you know, the Russians feel like they need a buffer between themselves and NATO. They say NATO is the new threat. I don't see NATO as a threat to Russia at all, but they see it that way, and you have to understand their perceptions. So I think this is all part of it. And in fact, some of the exercises up there, some of their senior officers and senior officials talked about the threat of NATO in the Arctic. And so I think this is all part about it. You know, they felt like they need a buffer zone in Ukraine in case Ukraine leans towards the West, and especially if it joins NATO. They took Crimea. You know, they've tried to create this new organization that is similar to what some people say is the former Soviet Union, obviously not in, you know, wouldn't include something in Eastern Europe. And the other end of in the high north, it's the Arctic that they may feel vulnerable about. So I think these things are all related to Russian security, their perception of the security environment, and then, of course, I think economics.
But this may have more to do with projection than it does with the reality, as you say. One of the things that of course, in response to the Ukraine aggression, we've seen NATO adopt is the European Union and others sanctions on the transfer of technology to Russia that would be necessary for them to exploit the kind of inaccessible but very considerable resources of the Arctic. Do you anticipate that there will be, as a result of further Russian misbehavior with respect to Ukraine, Peter Brooks, still more pressure in that vein? And so does this really amount to, an assertion of control without being able to exploit those resources on the part of the Russians?
Well, I mean, I think Europe, NATO, the United States needs to look at this closely. I mean, they're having problems. You know, I would say it's like herding cats when it comes to sanctions. People don't necessarily, you know, they're concerned about their economic livelihood. And if they have major trading relationships with Russia, they're concerned about those sort of sanctions. But nobody seems to really want to deal with the issue in Ukraine outside of sanctions. I mean, they don't want to arm the Ukrainian government, which kind of surprises me, because I think most people would agree that a country has the right to self-defense. And I think what Russia has aggressed against Ukraine. whether you're talking about Crimea or what's going on in the eastern part of the country. And so I think that they, you know, under UN law, international law, I mean, you have a right to request help, and there's a right to, you know, support them militarily. And there's been a reluctance to do that. So the only thing you really have besides rhetoric is economic sanctions. But once again, you know, creating a sanctions regime is one thing, but maintaining it is another.
Let alone trying to stiffen it in the face of continuing misbehavior. Hey, Peter Brooks, let me turn very quickly. And again, our guest is a senior fellow on national security affairs at the Heritage Foundation, also formerly a deputy assistant secretary of defense for Asian and Pacific affairs. I know you've recently written on Yemen, Peter, and I wanted to get your thoughts on what's happening there. It seems as though it's going from bad to considerably worse.
Well, yeah, I mean, the situation, I mean, it's interesting that the president talked about this being a, you know, a model counterterrorism operation back in September, just 6 months ago. And now we've not only closed our embassy in Sana'a, the capital, we're also pulled out our military advisors. I mean, you know, these are special forces types. I mean, these are pretty tough guys. So the situation is, you know, has gone very, very bad. It's not going to help us at all in terms of prosecuting counterterrorism operations, which the administration says it plans to continue to do, because we're not going to have, you know, we're not going to be completely deaf, dumb, and blind in the country because there are other ways, you know, there's technical intelligence and other things, but we're going to have less knowledge of what's really happening on the ground there.
And ability, presumably, to influence events as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the other thing is, or to get firsthand accounts of what's happening, as opposed to getting it secondhand. The other thing is that you know the you have ISIS is you know has planted a flag there. In fact, they were responsible for the bombing of a Shiite mosque or two Shiite mosques last week. They killed more than 100 people. Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is the ones infamous for their innovative bomb making, such as the underwear bombs. You have Iranian-backed forces. I mean, you almost potentially you could say, I think they are in a civil war. Some people say they're on the verge of a civil war. I think it is a civil war. But I think you have no central government. And you have Saudi Arabia and Iran in a proxy war there, I think, between the Shia-backed Houthi rebels and the what's left of the central government, which is Sunni.
A real witch's brew. And unfortunately, as you say, Peter Brooks, it's almost certainly going to get worse. Peter, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much the work you do at the Heritage Foundation, and thank you so much. Keep it up. Next up, our Asia hand, Gordon Chang, joins us on China on the Rocks and its lash out at multinational corporations. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Welcome back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, the man we turn to each week for an update on matters involving Asia. As it happens, he's just returned from Asia, and it's a special privilege to be able to pick his brains, having had an opportunity to sort of canvass the situation personally and directly. Gordon is, of course, a columnist with Forbes.com, also with WorldAffairsJournal.com, and you can find his longer works, his published books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, at Amazon and outstanding booksellers elsewhere. Gordon, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Glad you've made it back safe and sound. We consider you a national treasure, and I'm so glad nothing bad befell you over there, despite your candor about what's going on in China and elsewhere. Gordon, let me talk about first news that seems to be breaking as we speak about further Western nations becoming party to the Asia Development Bank that was kind of set up, as I understand it, by the Chinese as a sort of, well, alternative to an American-dominated one. post-World War II that has been the sort of mainstay of international development banking. What does this mean both for China and for America's position in the Pacific?
Beijing has sponsored the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. There's going to be a meeting at the end of this month in Kazakhstan where Beijing and a number of countries that are participating in the bank will meet to draw up the final shareholder stakes and also the organizational documents for the bank. Beijing it hopes that this will be an alternative to both the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, which is really sponsored by Japan and the United States and based in the Philippines. And essentially, Beijing is trying to set up parallel institutions. It's going to be very interesting to see if this works. Of course, a lot of countries, over the objections of the Obama administration, have decided to put capital into Beijing's bank. But it's not exactly clear that this thing will get off the ground, and even if it does, whether it will work. Beijing basically wants the bank to invest in a lot of infrastructure to permit, essentially, China to sell its exports in Central Asia. This is not exactly an economic plan, and the question is whether the loans the bank will make will actually be sustainable. There's a lot to talk about here, but clearly the United States has lost the argument. But it's important for America to make the argument that the bank needs to have high standards of governance and certainly needs to have Beijing with a much lower role, in other words, not a veto role, because otherwise this just becomes an institution with very little substance apart from its Beijing backing.
Do you think those sorts of changes are going to be in the offing, Gordon? It sounds as though the Europeans and even the Japanese are buying in on China's terms, or am I missing something here?
We don't know exactly how this will work out. The big issue here is that Beijing wants 49% of the capital, which essentially gives it a veto on the bank's operations. And if Beijing runs this essentially by itself, then we know what the Chinese do. They create these unsustainable loans. If, however, the European and the Asian participation outside of China actually makes this bank like the World Bank, like the Asian Development Bank, then yeah, this will not be a disaster or a debacle. We just have to see how it works out. I don't know what the Chinese attitude is going to be on the 49%. That's really going to be the critical test of its intentions about whether Beijing is just willing to override everybody else's views or is willing to take a much lower role of management in the bank.
Based on what you've taught us over the years about the Chinese sort of rising nationalist tendencies, and particularly those of Xi Jinping, that it would seem as though taking a lower profile role is not exactly in their makeup at the moment. But speaking of which, Gordon, you have now written about a subject we've discussed in the past, David Shambaugh's assessment, which seems now to align pretty closely with yours, that the Communist Party in China is facing an incipient crack-up. Again, how does that changing dynamic likely translate into its conduct, not just with respect to this international banking operation, but with respect to its neighbors and our interests as well?
I'm very concerned that a weak China will lash out against its neighbors. You know, we've seen much more provocative behavior over the last 4 or 5 years. Xi Jinping clearly is a nationalist willing to use Chinese powers in ways that trouble the neighbors and the United States. And a weak China could actually try to create problems to really distract the Chinese people from problems at home. The thing about David Shambaugh's essay in the Wall Street Journal is that Shambaugh has traditionally been one of Beijing's favorite China watchers because he's been so supportive of the Communist Party. I mean, he used to argue that China's critics just didn't understand the country, didn't understand the Communist Party, and that they should get on board supporting Chinese communism. So for him to write this essay that the Communist Party is in its final days really is stunning. And that means we're probably going to see big changes in China's foreign policy, and probably not ones for the better.
Do you think that's the end of David Shambaugh's visas in China? Are they going to cut him off after this kind of deviation from the party line?
Probably. Global Times, which is a publication, a very nationalist one, controlled by People's Daily, has chased after Shambaugh in pretty harsh terms. The Communist Party probably is going to try to turn Shambaugh around. I mean, they never give up on people. So we don't know whether they will actually take away his visa. But I think that they will try to turn him one way or another. But the point is, right now, there are a lot of people, apart from Shambao, who are starting to see the real weaknesses of the Communist Party and are starting to believe that there is a short time frame. So it's not just Shambao, it's many others as well.
It clearly is the case that at some point the facts are the facts, and even those disinclined to see them are going to be confronting them, hopefully, with the clarity that you bring to all of this, Gordon Chang. Again, our guest is a columnist with Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. Gordon, let me ask you about one other facet of what China's up to at the moment. You've recently written about a lashing out that China is engaged in with multinational corporations doing business there. What does it mean for the corporations immediately involved, and what does it suggest about both the Communist Party and the attitude towards capitalism that they have espoused pretty much in their fashion, at least, since Deng Xiaoping?
Well, last Wednesday, the State Tax Administration issued rules on transfer pricing. And by themselves, you know, transfer pricing rules are not objectionable. But in the hands of China, which has no standards, this is going to be a problem for the companies. Because we have seen, especially since the middle of 2013, a concerted attack on foreign companies. Basically, Xi Jinping, the new ruler, has been using China's laws in very discriminatory ways against multinationals, first in the anti-monopoly area, then in the bribery area. Now we're seeing tax being used as a weapon. And this really means that the opportunities for foreign companies in China are narrowing and that they're going to be subject to attacks perhaps unprecedented. This is basically a closing of the Chinese economy off from foreign investors in an attempt to build up strong state enterprises. So this is, of course, bad news.
Does this mean that fundamentally the effort to try to wean China off of state-owned enterprises, which were for many years under Mao, particularly the backbone of its economy, such as it was, is a thing of the past, Gordon, and that essentially now China has reached a place where it believes, the Communist Party particularly, believes that it can provide what it needs internally and that it will essentially export but not do much importing?
It certainly looks that way because, especially since the middle of December, we have seen Xi Jinping consolidate already large state enterprises into monopolies. We've seen an increase of state subsidies to state enterprises. And clearly, this is a move away from a more open economy towards one, which is really Maoist-inspired. The idea is Xi Jinping's Chinese dream, which is a strong Chinese state. And to have a strong Chinese state, he believes you need to have state enterprises as the backbone of the economy. And that's why we're seeing these attacks on multinationals, because this is also one aspect of his attempt to build up state business. And this is really a move back to the 1950s.
Neo-Maoism, as I think you and others have called it. Gordon, you get credit for the best headline of the year, China's Thousand Shades of Gray, a new campaign against multinationals. Find it at Forbes.com, folks. And follow all of Gordon's terrific writing at GordonChang.com. Gordon, as always, we appreciate tremendously your service to us here at Secure Freedom Radio as elsewhere, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you so much. Keep it up and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.